Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We use that stormy weather music enough already on the program lately, but I'm just saying, brace yourself for still more dark clouds on the economic horizon. The latest global forecast, sorry to say, is rather gloomy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdal. Glad to have you with us this Tuesday, the 20th of September. So, the global economy has entered a dangerous new phase. Not my words, mind you. That's a quote today from the chief economist of the International Monetary Fund. The IMF just lowered its estimates for growth in the U.S. and Europe, which means it'll be harder for European countries to rein in their debt. Greek officials were huddling again today on what to do to keep from defaulting. But given this latest outlook, what's the risk to the U.S.? American banks have just gotten on their feet from our own crisis back in 2008. Are they going to get knocked down again? Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore reports.
Among American banks that are big players in foreign markets, Citigroup has the most at stake. Six of every $10 it makes comes from overseas. So you'd think Citigroup would be at risk from the European debt crisis. Well, not so much. Europe's most troubled countries are Portugal, Ireland, Italy, Greece, and Spain. Citigroup has about $14 billion in loans to the governments and companies there. Got that? $14 billion. Now, here's some context. Citigroup's total assets are about $2 trillion.
We know that the direct exposure to the European countries is fairly limited from the large U.S. banks, and it doesn't exist at the small U.S. financial institutions.
That's Fred Cannon, head of research for Keefe, Bruyette & Woods.
From a big picture standpoint, it looks like the U.S. banking system and economy should be somewhat insulated.
But we could be part of the collateral damage if Europe's debt crisis makes executives and bankers worry about doing business there. Larry Cantor is the global head of research for Barclays Capital. He says this crisis isn't about banks yet. It's about governments.
Investors are doubting the ability of some of these countries to make good on their debt. That's a bad thing. But it's really a sovereign debt crisis that could create a bank crisis.
Cantor says it's hard to predict the full damage until Europe figures out how to handle its problems. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
First, he tried the conciliatory soft sell approach, but that didn't seem to work. So this week, President Obama has drawn a line in the sand when it comes to cutting the deficit. He's now declared that if the GOP won't raise taxes on the rich, any cuts to entitlements will be dead on arrival. The super committee charged with slashing the deficit is similarly polarized, which brings us to this harsh reality. If Democrats and Republicans can't compromise and do it by Thanksgiving, we're in for automatic, indiscriminate cuts. Marketplace's David Gura tells us what that might look and feel like.
This is what happens if the supercommittee can't find a way to cut $1.5 trillion from the deficit.
A straight across-the-board slash that'll be split evenly between defense and non-defense programs.
That's Ryan McConaghy. He's with a centrist think tank called Third Way.
You really take a buzzsaw to the budget, and, you know, wasteful programs and worthwhile ones get cut just the same.
McConaghy says if there's no deal, a lot is at risk. Salaries for Border Patrol agents and food inspectors, funding for schools and highways, and for the military. Todd Harrison is with the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments.
We're looking at pretty steep and pretty abrupt cuts in things like acquisition funding for weapon systems.
The Pentagon could scale back on peacetime operations. It could limit the flights pilots take and how long ships stay at sea. Right now, it's hard to say what would take the biggest hit, but we do know some things are safe. Phil Swagel is with the American Enterprise Institute.
Many of the most important programs supporting people with low incomes, so supporting those most in need, would be exempt from the cuts. So Medicaid, for example.
Medicare benefits would stay the same, but government payments to providers could change. The automatic cuts wouldn't take effect until 2013, and that leaves plenty of time for a new Congress to throw these rules out the window. That's because one Congress can't dictate spending rules to the next. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
As of today, you can go ahead and ask, and it shouldn't matter what the answer is. The repeal of the military policy known as Don't Ask, Don't Tell became effective at midnight. But not before more than 14,000 men and women were forced to leave the military because of their sexual orientation. As Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports, amid celebrations planned across the country, some are marking the occasion by reapplying for their old jobs.
For months now, 34-year-old Jeremy Johnson has been planning for this day, his first opportunity to re-enlist and serve his country as an openly gay man.
I've been working with recruiters since last October. He's got a package more or less completed. I just have one more form to fill out.
He wants to join the reserves while he finishes college. After that, he hopes to become an officer. He served before 10 years in the Navy. It ended when he came out as gay and was shown the door. Predictably, he gets lots of questions about why he'd want to go back. Johnson responds by asking people to think about a job they love.
If they have a job that they're passionate about, but they were forced out of unfairly, and maybe that unfairness was corrected, if you were that invested, had 10 years in that job, and could make a career out of it, would you go back? And that's kind of how I look at my career.
Carlos Miranda has been working as a registered nurse since he was kicked out of the military after 8 years of service. He's now planning to apply for a job in the Air Force Reserves.
It will be a great opportunity for me to get back into the military and be a part of something bigger than myself and hopefully accumulate another source of retirement.
Retirement is a sore issue for Ed Lopez. He had invested 17 years in his Navy career. When he was discharged, Lopez was a chief petty officer.
I received commendations, medals, and at the point where it was found out that I was gay, then all of that meant nothing.
Lopez was forced out 3 years shy of the 20 years needed to retire with full benefits for life. That would have entitled Lopez to half his normal salary, about $1,500 a month.
I figure I would have earned about $200,000 to date in retirement pay, and that really doesn't take into account any of the health benefits or medical benefits or anything. That would have been just regular base pay.
Lopez says his decision to re-enlist is about more than money. He wants to wrap up his military career with dignity. But first, he needs to be hired. Just because gays can serve in the military doesn't guarantee them jobs. Again, Jeremy Johnson.
The retention across the military is high. The Marine Corps has a waiting list to get in.
The Pentagon is winding down two wars and facing huge budget cuts.
It used to be that the military provided a lot of job security. While that's still true to some degree, at least in the Navy, there's no such thing as this absolute guaranteed career anymore.
Traditionally, the military has hired veterans to make up for staff shortfalls. But the Defense Department says it has fewer vacancies to be filled. In other words, gays are welcome to apply, but there are fewer jobs and they're harder to get. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
The graph on Wall Street today looks something like the track of a balloon that floated high most of the day and then developed a leak in the hour before the close. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You'll probably never guess what question occurred to us this morning around the table at our story meeting.
Why do we offer flu shots at Walgreens every day?
Well, yeah, actually, that was pretty much what we wondered. And not just there. Same for CVS and Rite Aid. Summer is not even officially over till Friday, but it's pretty hard to miss the signs outside nearly every pharmacy pushing walk-in appointments and promotions on flu shots. So why is this such big business when flu season usually doesn't get going till December? We asked Marketplace's Jennifer Collins to find out.
Pharmacies are looking to turn getting a flu shot into a competition. Listen to these ladies.
I was the first to get a flu shot.
You didn't make an appointment yet.
Don't need one at Walgreens.
Drugstores and supermarket pharmacies provide around 20% of the flu shots in the U.S. every year. They've been steadily stealing market share from doctors.
Getting a flu shot from a physician can be a big hassle.
That's Catherine Harris of the RAND Corporation. She says pharmacies earn around 30% profit on flu vaccines. They also bring people in the door, people who may pick up a bottle of shampoo or a tube of toothpaste on the way out. Analyst John Heinbockel of Guggenheim Partners says vaccines also get
people to think about a drugstore as being more of a healthcare location.
Heinbachel says stores have been adding clinics and other medical services as part of a larger plan to broaden their business.
The profitability of filling prescriptions will probably go down. They'll need to replace that profit with something else. And services around the pharmacy is a good way to do that.
He says the vaccine can be a tough sell in a year like this one, when money is tight and there's no big scary flu strain. And there's always that fear of needles excuse. But it may not work so well anymore. Some shots are coming with new, much thinner needles. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
They have come to be known as genius grants, but the MacArthur Foundation prefers to avoid that term, pointing out that its prestigious award doesn't just recognize intellectual prowess. Today, this year's winners were announced. Out of the blue, each of those 22 recipients will be getting $500,000, no strings attached. Roland Fryer is one of the winners this year. He teaches economics at Harvard University. Dr. Fryer, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
The MacArthur Fellowship is described as an investment in a person's originality, insight, and potential. So, Dr. Fryer, we'd appreciate you sharing some of that insight with us. You study race and economic achievement. Can you flesh that out for us? What do you look at and how?
I'm interested in racial inequality broadly, and it turns out that if you look at educational achievement of, say, an eighth grader, it's very predictive of their income later, the probability of being incarcerated, their health, et cetera. So what I do is try to figure out how can we develop scalable solutions that allow all kids to reach their potential in terms of educational achievement.
Why, when you're looking at inequality, are you specializing in education? Is that where you think things start?
Well, you know, what really plays a big role is how well you do in school. I mean, the civil rights issue, part of the civil rights battle was the battle for access to quality public education. Now, you know, we have lots of access, but the real 21st century civil rights issue, it seems to me, is the battle for quality public schools in every neighborhood. There is a 34% difference in income in this country between full-time workers who are black and full-time workers who are white. However, if you just account for eighth grade test scores, how they do on these standardized tests in eighth grade, that 34% difference goes down to about 5%. Hmm. And so it doesn't wipe it out all the way, so there's still room for all sorts of anti-discrimination policy, et cetera. However, if you were going to focus on one thing, it would be trying to figure out how we can give kids of every zip code and color the access to the same quality education. So that's why I've pursued that avenue, because I think it will explain a lot.
One of the things you've done is paid kids for good grades, where a student gets $50 for an A in class. What did you find in those cases?
When we paid kids for doing particular behaviors, like we paid them to read books or we paid them to come to class and behave, those showed statistically significant effects. But when we paid kids for just getting good test scores or getting good grades, they were excited but frankly didn't really know what to do. They didn't they didn't think to themselves, hey, now that I'm getting money for a test, I should read a book. They didn't think that second step. And so what we found is that if you design the incentives right, they can be powerful motivators to increase achievement.
And what are you working on now?
What we're doing now is trying to figure out how we can take some of the most promising education innovations like the Harlem Children's Zone, KIPP Academy, Yes Prep, these some of the really successful charter schools, and boil their success down to a form that can be transplanted into traditional public schools. I mean, you'll remember that part of the promise of charter schools was to be an incubator for best practices and good ideas for the public schools. That's where my work is now. It's trying to figure out. It's a real quest for a scalable solution to solve the racial achievement gap in America.
Well, you have some new financial will. Are you going to use that $500,000 cash prize that comes with this grant to pursue your work?
I absolutely am. I am going to use it with this MacArthur Fellowship. One of the real beauties of it is that, you know, if there's a project that I really want and we can't find funding for it, you know, MacArthur's already given it to me for the next 5 years. So that's a really, really great feeling.
Roland Fryer teaches economics at Harvard University. Congratulations, sir.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, the underground economy isn't just counterfeit goods and drug deals. It's also a lifeline.
People who are cutting hair inside their house. Some people are prepare your taxes.
But first, let's do the numbers. At the close, the Dow Jones Industrial Average added 7 points, less than 0.1%, to end the day at 11,408. The NASDAQ dropped 22 points, 0.8%, to close at 2590. The S&P 500 ticked down 2 points, 0.1%, to finish at 1202. General Motors rolled down 2.75%. GM agreed to a 4-year deal with the United Auto Workers that will add or keep 6,400 jobs in the U.S. Carnival sailed up 5% after the cruise ship company beat earnings expectations. What do investors think of the new Netflix so far? Return to sender. The movie rental company lost another quick 9.5% today after dropping 7% yesterday. Newmont Mining hauled in a 5.5% gain after its CEO predicted gold prices could reach $2,300 an ounce by the end of the year. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes for August. A Senate subcommittee on antitrust, competition policy, and consumer rights holds a hearing titled The Power of Google: Serving Consumers or Threatening Competition. Also in Washington, the Department of Education convenes its second annual anti-bullying summit. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdal. It's no secret by now that Chinese counterfeiters are the source of many pirated goods here, from fake Gucci bags to illegally copied DVDs. But there's a new kind of knockoff making its way from China these days. It seems many in the underage crowd are shelling out their allowance for Chinese-made fake IDs. From WBEZ in Chicago, Tony Arnold reports.
So I'm here at my computer. I've got a search window up, and I'm typing buy fake IDs from. And Google's autofill finishes my thought with from China. Turns out there are any number of websites that offer fake IDs for many of the 50 states. They cost around $100, and like other Chinese knockoffs, they're really hard to tell from the original.
It would take more of a forensic analysis to really detect the fake ID.
Mike Rankins with the Ohio Bureau of Motor Vehicles. He says customs officials in his state and others have seized thousands of fake IDs from China. Here in Chicago, the number is 1,700 so far this year. Many of the fakes had the same holograms and watermarks states use to ensure authenticity.
It's not just for underage drinking anymore. I think it's for persons trying to facilitate a range of fraudulent conduct, whether it be illegal immigration, obtaining credit.
High-quality printing is a specialty of Chinese counterfeiters, says Chris Bailey. He works in Guangzhou, China, with the company Rouse, a firm that focuses on intellectual property rights.
The counterfeiters want repeat business. They want to be able to sell their products.
Bailey says some companies in China's industrial printing sector have long used their facilities for counterfeits, like packaging for knockoff cigarettes or medicines. It takes the counterfeiters little time to figure out how to make realistic-looking fakes.
Sometimes it's a matter of months, really.
The Chinese government doesn't condone counterfeiting, Bailey says, yet does little to stop it either. But is there always a market for a realistic-looking Illinois driver's license courtesy of a factory in Guangdong province? To find out, I met with 20-year-old Michelle, who agreed to meet at a diner to talk about fake IDs, as long as I didn't use her full name. She's had 4 fake IDs, and they haven't come cheap.
It was like 100 for that, like, fake, another 100 for, maybe I have spent more than, like, $300 at this point.
As a result of all the risks involved in using a fake, Michelle has rules for when to use it. No liquor stores, no grocery stores, just use it to get into clubs. Michelle's other rule about fake IDs, get them from a known source. That's why she says she's not interested in buying a fake Chinese ID online.
They're supposed to be really good.
That's what I hear. Apparently they're like really legitimate, but quite honestly, I don't want to mess with that, no.
Michelle says she wasn't comfortable sharing personal information online, and she convinced her friends to back out, too. In the meantime, she's getting by with her current fake until her 21st birthday. In Chicago, I'm Tony Arnold from Marketplace.
When we talk about unemployment here in the U.S., there are things we know, some of us all too well. The unemployment rate holds steady at 9.1%, and there we netted no additional jobs in the month of August. And then there are the unknowns. What about the folks who work off the books, people making cash in what's known as the underground economy? Sudhir Venkatesh is a professor of sociology at Columbia University who studies the underground economy. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be here. Thank you.
First off, a definition of what we're talking about by the underground economy. That conjures up the black market in a way. It's not all illegal behavior, though, is it?
No. We can split the underground economy into two different sectors. And as you're saying, one is the criminal side. But there's a lot of stuff that's out there that is not criminal by any means. It's just that the income is not reported to the government. So people who are cutting hair inside their house, some people are prepare your taxes. And so that's probably even a greater percentage of the activities and the income that's in the underground economy.
Well, given that it's not reported, I'd assume it's not easy to come up with concrete numbers about the size of the underground economy. But what do we know about how it's grown in the past few years?
Well, you put 10 economists in the room and ask them to define the underground economy or the size of it, you'll get 11 different estimations.
I've heard that before.
And I'll just give you a couple. If you just do it relative to GDP, the economist Friedrich Schneider estimates that it's about 8% of GDP. There are studies by the GEO that suggest that one out of every six purchases is made in the underground economy. We do know that there are things, however, that make it grow. In a tightened regulatory climate, businesses will often switch to underground economic relationships, meaning that they might have paid you on the books one day, and over time, if they start fearing that they're going to have to pay more taxes, and they'll change to an informal relationship with you.
Have you seen changes as a result of the recession, both in terms of the underground economic activities and the types of people who might be engaging in them?
I think there is certainly a driver in the recession in that it will lead to overall increases in the underground economy, but you just don't know how it's going to affect particular kinds of groups. So that in a service sector environment where so much of their costs are based on manpower, you'll see a greater reliance on casual hiring. In a manufacturing sector, you may not have that same kind of relationship.
You've interviewed lots of people who are doing this type of work. Any stories particularly striking?
I remember going to Chicago and seeing an elaborate network whereby the small businesses in the south side of the city took out cash altogether as a means of interacting with each other. There was an auto repair shop in which Leroy, the owner of the auto repair shop, he just no longer had a cash register. His customers would come in. They might pay him with a cell phone, or they might pay him with a promise of painting his house. He would take that note and he would exchange it for someone else. They just simply did not have the cash to make payments. And you would have never seen that if you just walked in and made a purchase. And I think that shows the ways in which the underground economy is quite invisible, but it teaches us a lot.
The black market always exists, whether the economy is doing poorly or not. Should we be concerned by these types of activities, or is it just an alternative way to make a buck in tough times?
Because the underground economy is invisible, it is something that you don't report to the government, you may feel over time that you're doing something wrong. Then you start to feel like you don't have value as a worker, as a laborer. That means that that same person, when times get better, might have difficulty going into an employer who says, well, so what have you been doing for the past year? It becomes difficult to say, well, I've been painting houses in the underground economy. And so you may have to make up a story, or you may just avoid the question altogether, or worse, you might avoid the interview, and that's the worst thing. Those are the reasons that we don't want an underground economy to be thriving.
Sudhir Venkatesh is a professor of sociology at Columbia University. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, if you're going to cut the fat in government, what better place to start than extravagant spending on food? The Justice Department's Inspector General just finished an audit on what the department has been paying for food at conferences. Too much, it seems. The report out today found the Justice Department spent more than $73 million on conferences in 2009, compared to around $48 million just a year earlier. And it blames things like Cracker Jacks and candy bars served at one break at a cost of $32 per person. At another gathering, the cost of muffins figured out to $16 per muffin. I guess they were made with enriched flour. And that's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow added 7 points, less than 0.1%. The Nasdaq dropped 22 points, 0.8%. The S&P 500 down 2 points, 0.1%. Thanks to Doug Krisner, Ethan Lindsay, and Jolie Podokas on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rada Bead. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And next time on this program, there's a good reason no one hitchhikes anymore. And it doesn't have to do with kidnappings or murder.
Between 1960 and 2000, the share of American households with two or three cars tripled.
The Freakonomics of Hitchhiking. I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join Kai back here for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.